Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Hi, folks. It's Peter Bregan. And today we have a sober subject, electroshock treatment, the FDA seeking to dispense it freely as it is done now to even probably really make it even more freely to the American public. My guest is Ted Jabosinski, who is a most courageous and interesting man. And Ted, are you there?
Yep. Yes, I am.
Before I talk with Ted, I thought what I would do, Ted, I'm thinking about 5 minutes of background on this. Just so people, I realize not everybody knows anything about electroshocks. Let me give a little brief background.
Peter, something technical here. It may just be my phone, but your voice is breaking. Perhaps you're an engineer.
My voice is breaking. That is...
I don't know if the average listener is hearing it, but it's, I don't know what it is.
I think it's important to deal with it because, in fact, we've had the problem once before.
I see.
And I'm going to just let him know. You know, last time one of my guests, my voice was breaking up. The recording showed it was breaking up afterward when it went to archives. I'm just not sure if there's anything we can do about this. Let me check with our engineers, our great engineers at PRN, and see what they're telling me. They're just going to tell me to go ahead.
Probably, yeah.
All right. Let me start over again. We're going to take a music break. We're going to reconnect. With the news, music. Yeah, and this is Dr. Peter Bregan returning to talk with Ted Jabosinski about ECT. ECT was developed in 1938 when psychiatrists all over the world were looking at new ways to do lobotomy and brain damage. It was very clear what they were doing. And they came to the conclusion that electricity was more efficient than lobotomy, and indeed within a short time, passing an electric current through the brain, putting a person into a coma and into a grand mal convulsion became much more popular than lobotomy. It's impossible to estimate the tens of millions of people who have been brutalized in this manner with multiple closed head electrical injuries. I wrote the first medical book critical of this in 1979, and I have a website called ECT ectresources.org, ectresources.org. That has my 79 book for free, multiple more recent articles for me for free, and has dozens and dozens of scientific articles showing that ECT is a brutalizing, destructive methodology. It's so brutal that it's been used in CIA experiments. You can look that up on the website, ectresources.org. It's been used. I was on a 60 Minutes show a few decades ago because ECT was used on a whole group of black activists in the Navy on the grounds that they were mentally ill for being black activists, and it certainly did subdue them. It's been used in whole wards of people in the early years to keep them quieted down. The idea that it was some curative treatment is entirely a fabrication of modern times. People forever in the beginning knew they were causing brain damage. They had research studies showing it was brain damage, causing brain damage. Then in 1985, the federal government held what's called a consensus conference, where they bring together experts pro and con on a treatment, and then they have, quote, objective scientists evaluate it. There's hundreds and hundreds of people in the audience. It's carried in the news. And I was asked to be the scientific expert presenting on brain pathology from ECT. I documented very clearly from the scientific literature. And the consensus conference, which are always establishment-oriented, concluded on an average, people lose 10 of their lives through memory loss, 2 after the ECT and 8 before. On an average, this is what the government's hand-picked, non-controversial people concluded. They also concluded there was no evidence for any help from ECT beyond 4 weeks. And what I pointed out to them is that's the point of time when you have your worst acute organic brain syndrome, your worst delirium, so that the person cannot feel their real feelings. All they can do is be submissive and agree to things or be speechless, in which case the doctors always rate them improved. That's the mindset of the ECT docs. You know, how are you doing? Okay, well, that's a great improvement. The patient is numb for the first 4 weeks. But even the consensus conference, this official government document, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 86, the conference in 85, all this on ectresources.org, even they said, you know, 4 weeks. They also said it is the most controversial treatment in the history of psychiatry. So given that, you'd think the federal government, Food and Drug Administration, would at least say that ECT is dangerous enough to need testing, the same way that, you know, a new form of aspirin might need testing, or the same way a new gadget might need testing, or certainly the same way a psychiatric drug, even a new variation on an old drug, would need testing. But FDA, if having tentatively said yes, it belongs in the category 3 where that needs testing, and we're going to do testing. It caved into pressure, despite the fact that 80% of the people who sent in materials to the FDA said this was damaging and dangerous. They decided, under pressure from the Psychiatric Association, mainly, I believe, then the manufacturers and the shock doctors, they decided, despite even the consensus conference, that actually they could approve this thing without testing. That they could approve it without testing. So what they're proposing is they're going to reclassify from their previous 3 down to 2, which means that it will be usable by anybody who's got a severe depressive disorder or bipolar disorder, 18 years and older. It means that everybody the shock doctors want to shock, they can classify as bipolar. Heck, they've been able to you know, 40 times increased diagnoses of children with bipolar disorder at the wave of a wand. So it just has opened the floodgates. And by the way, schedule this classification down to two may mean that you don't have to be a medical doctor to do it. That assistants and aides can do it. That's my understanding, what I've gotten from some experts on what happens when you get on a schedule to two, to category two. So it's a disaster. It's evil. It reflects the horror of modern psychiatry and its grip on federal government. The mental health lobby is one of the largest in the country, together with the pharmaceutical industry. It's the biggest one in the country. Well, we're looking at a disaster. And into that situation now, I introduce my friend and colleague, Ted Chabasinski. Ted, are you there still?
Yeah, I'm here, ready to talk.
Am I sounding any clearer than I was at the beginning?
No. Oh, I don't think the engineer could. Maybe something. We're both separated from where this is coming from, right? And you may have a bad microphone or something. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe so.
Because I heard the engineer very clearly, so I think it's coming from your end there. But anyway, I can understand you. So yeah. You're introducing me. What would you like me to say, Peter?
Well, I think one thing, why don't you talk some about your history? This is a man that I greatly admire, who got the worst of psychiatry, including ECT, thrown at him when he was a child, landed in a mental hospital, rebuilt his life, got a law degree, became an advocate for oppressed people and oppressed mental patients for a good portion of his life, and who at one point in time led a protest which shut down an ECT ward. The only time in history it's ever been done. So, Ted, do you want to say anything more about yourself?
Yeah, my mom was, had the label of schizophrenia, and at the time, which was 1937 when I was born, the theory was that so-called schizophrenia was inherited. So my mother put me up for, well, she put me in this child welfare agency because she didn't feel she could take care of me, and they put me in a foster home, and the foster parents were actually quite nice. But the agency, when they were asked to provide this Dr. Loretta Bender, who was very famous, one of the things she did was experiment with shock treatment on children, and I was one of those children, and you can bet there were no, you know, kids of hedge fund managers or whatever in the cohort of kids that were shocked. I mean, we were all poor kids, mostly from foster homes. And I was sent to Bellevue Hospital in New York, and I got 20 shock treatments, and I couldn't remember what happened to me afterwards, and they took that as a sign of mental, you know, that I wasn't being cured of my schizophrenia, although, of course, we all know now it was from the shock treatment, and I was sent to Rockland State Hospital in New York, and this was in the 40s and 50s, you know, the time of the snake pits. In fact, the Rockland State Hospital was actually where the book, the book, The Snake Pit, came from. The writer was had been an inmate at Rockland State Hospital, and I heard about this when the book was out. So at 7, 8, or 9 years old, I knew that I was in the genuine snake pit. But anyway, I spent 10 years there, and I knew that I needed an education, and I worked my way through college, and I went to graduate school in psychology for a while, and ultimately I became a lawyer, and I got involved in the psych survivors movement, we call ourselves. And in, I think Peter wanted me to talk about this, in 1982, there was a group called the Network Against Psychiatric Assault, was led by Leonard Frank and Wade Hudson. Leonard died recently. He was a shock survivor. He had about 70 shock treatments, and he was just a tremendous man. But anyway, they organized the Network Against Psychiatric Assault. They actually stopped shock treatment informally in San Francisco because the hospitals that did shock treatment, they were getting so much bad PR, they just gave up. I mean, there was one incredibly dramatic demonstration, which I wasn't there for, where Shock had been being done in a place called St. Mary's Hospital. It was run by, I don't know what, how the Catholic Church is structured, by the parish or whatever of St. Mary's. And the Napa people went into a Catholic church during a mass to protest the fact that they were doing shock treatment, which really is a very immoral thing to do. But anyway, with all this background, I found myself in Berkeley, and I got involved with a local progressive party there that was very receptive to our message that, you know, there was all this abuse of psychiatry, and we had one of the most busy shock wards in the Bay Area. And I was able to put on the ballot a ban, Measure T, which would have banned shock treatment in Berkeley. And everybody said, you don't have a chance, it'll never happen,
Ted,
blah, blah, blah.
While we're thinking about you don't have a chance, we're going to go to a music break, and I'm going to reconnect to the studio.
Okay.
So hang on. And I'm working on a little technical problems. And Ted, can you hear me good now?
Yeah, it seems to be better. Your voice is
all right, sir. Well, go ahead.
Continue with where I was. So everybody was saying we couldn't possibly do it, but what actually happened is we won by almost 2-1. Unfortunately, the psychiatrist went into a frenzy and they got a judge to rule that the city didn't have the authority to ban shock treatment. So, but meanwhile, it got international publicity. I was just amazed. There was a newspaper in Amsterdam called Die Volkskrant, the People's Newspaper, and they were reporting on it on their front page. And it got, one of the things that delighted me is Leonard Frank, who I've mentioned already, he used to get all the professional publications, and I think it's Psychiatric News, correct me if I'm wrong, Peter, but they were asking at that time all of the candidates for office in the American Psychiatric Association what they thought were the three biggest problems the profession was facing at that time, and every single one of them mentioned the Berkeley shock ban as an example of how the public had lost faith in psychiatry. So I was very proud of that. And more recently, very recently, just last year, we had a lot of things have happened in the meanwhile, but something that I was involved with, we had on May 16th, we had 25 demonstrations against shock treatment in 9 countries, which was very exciting as well. The 9 countries were U.S., Canada, and the U.K., Ireland, Australia, and New Zealand, and then there were 3 South American countries, Chile, Argentina, and Uruguay. And mostly this just reflected where there are, you know, critical psychiatry movements. But it was exciting. It didn't get the kind of publicity that I had hoped for, though, but this struggle keeps continuing, and there's now, I think Peter may be talking about it later, these 2 marvelous activists from New York, Lauren Tenney and Celia Brown. Celia is the president of Mind Freedom International, and they're organizing about the current issue. So there's things going on, but it's a big fight. We don't have the power that the drug companies and the APA do, but we fight.
You're fighting really, really marvelously. I tried to help out with your international protests. I promoted them on Madden America, my blog, and I hope that they sent out a lot of my brochures. Folks, I made up a beautiful color brochure with some illustrations that you can download either as a brochure or as an essay from ectresources.org. It's free. It's a great thing to show to people
whose families may be getting shock treatment or people who are contemplating it. I really want folks to know how bad this thing is.
We did use ECTresources.com quite a bit in our May 16th demonstration. It is a wonderful resource. I think anybody who's listening to this program who wants the facts, they're right there and easy to absorb. So it is a marvelous resource, Peter, and we did use it.
Great. The ban was such an amazing accomplishment, and you did get, it sounds like, a number of demonstrations around the country. This issue with ECT and the fact that almost every human being cringes at the thought of it, and almost every doctor who says anything about it says, oh, yeah, it's life-saving. When there's no evidence at all for that, it's brain damaging. It's not life-saving. Have you ever gotten any – I mean, this is sort of asking you off the cuff because it certainly continues to puzzle me. I wonder why in the world the media, the physicians, and at times even juries. I've been an expert in the very first and only ECT case won in court, but I've also been an expert – and at that time, I was the only medical expert, the one we won. But I was in a very good case where we had three or four medical experts on our side, and the jury said no, they weren't going to call it malpractice. Is there something about this, Ted, that people just don't want to look at or can't bear? Have you any thoughts about it?
Well, I think, you know, I think psychiatry is kind of a religion, you see. And I have some not real hopeful thoughts about that. But I think, you know, life is tough, right? I mean, somebody, where did I just read this? Somebody was, oh, there was some Canadian talking about how unhappy Americans were. And he was saying that people found their lives so terrible that one out of four Americans, I think that's a little bit overstated, one out of four Americans was taking some kind of psychiatric drug. And then there's another statistic, which is it's a statistic about life expectancy among white middle-aged people in the United States, and it found that the life expectancy was going down, and what they traced that to was people taking hard, you know, illegal drugs like heroin and then these painkillers. Basically, you have a situation where people are just numbing themselves out because life is so terrible. So instead of having a society where you need to improve the society so people aren't miserable and unhappy. So, you know, it's a lot easier to take a pill than it is to face up to what you need to do to change your life. And so the psychiatrists have the pills already. Now, I've had plenty of bad times in my life. I'm going through one now. But, you know, the only way to really solve the problem is you just have to face it. And I think that psychiatry offers to let you numb yourself out. And so there's so many people numbing themselves out. And even as those new life expectancy figures show, even numbing themselves to death. And it's very bad. You know, you have a profession that tells you, yeah, take these drugs. And it's so much easier to do that and to try to convince yourself that it's true and to face the – I mean, if your life is miserable, the only way it's going to change, you're going to have to do something to change it. And I think a lot of people feel that it's hopeless. But I can tell you, I've been through terrible things in my life. I talked about some of them. But, you know, the only way to feel better is to change your life. It's not easy. But I think we need to change our culture, and I think that dissident psychiatrists like Peter, I mean, you talk a lot about empathetic therapy, and there's also a lot of other alternative things being discussed in different organizations, and we need to offer people things like that, emotional support and encouragement to, you know, grasp their lives and not sink into this feeling that all you can do is numb yourself out. And that's very hard. It's very hard. People want to numb themselves out. But I don't see But I think these life expectancy things are going to start making people wake up to what's wrong with this.
Can you tell me the source of the life expectancy study? And if you can't, you maybe just email it to me later.
Email it to you later. It's actually just been discussed very recently, like in the past week. There's some. I think it might have come from the CDC.
All right, so we can Google CDC and get it.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely some. This is not some, you know, little, you know, magazine saying drink more whatever, kale juice. There's nothing wrong with kale juice. But this is like very straight, you know, academic and government study that shows this incredible. I mean, all the developed countries, your trend for life expectancy is always going up. You know, it's 83 1 year and 84 5 years later. And this is the first time in a long time they've shown life expectancy going down, and they've traced it to the use of these. I'm not sure they said anything about psych drugs. They talk about opiates.
Ignore the psych drugs.
What?
That's what they always do.
Yeah, that's probably true too. I think the actual study probably will mention psych drugs, but the media.
No, my guess is they're going to ignore it.
Well, all I know
I'll look.
Is
I'm going to look,
report.
And
yeah, you can find it quite easily. I think listeners, if you just Google lowering life expectancy, United States, something like that, it'll come up. It's quite very recent.
It had to do a lot with the white middle class.
White, not so much middle. The more struggling people in the middle class, white working class people mostly. And as everybody knows, maybe not everybody doesn't know, but there's this huge epidemic of opioid addiction, and it's fueled, of course, by these companies that make tons of money pushing this stuff. Now, people might need some painkillers sometimes. They got a broken back or whatever, but people just get addicted to these opioids, and they just numb themselves out, and they basically give up. And you can't take these powerful drugs. It's very easy to overdose. And Peter, as a physician, you can say more about that, because I don't know a whole lot about how these things work. I do know that a lot of these deaths are from opioid overdoses or mixing drugs. You know, you could take a benzodiazepine and an opioid, and the two of them together are probably, you know, pretty dangerous. And you
well,
know more about
yes,
that
absolutely.
As a doctor than I would,
I think,
Peter.
You know, there's a lot of things that are also pressuring that group. I mean, that's a group now that has been very badly hit by 10 years of economic recession.
Yes.
It's a group that is being hammered for being bad people by the progressive movement to some extent, that, you know, that people aren't supposed to be proud of being white. They're supposed to be ashamed. I really do think that you probably disagree with me on that.
Yeah, we have differences in politics, Peter, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I know.
But I do think there's a lot of shaming of white people going on right now. And that is a group that is susceptible, you know, to the drugs, to the drug issues. And the suicide rate in that group of white males in particular has gone up as well.
Yeah. A lot of these life expectancy things, they say they trace it just straight out suicide. You know?
Yeah, well, there's no doubt that the suicide rate's been going up for several years now. I've looked at that data. And by the way, folks, I will at the start of next week's show, if I can, tell you my analysis of this study. I'll look at this study that we talked about today that I'm so glad Ted brought up. But the death rate in the middle classes from suicide for the first time is now highest or very high and growing in middle-aged white men. And I think that has to do, again, with the economic depression. Suicide goes up. And that group has been particularly hurt in terms of disillusionment. They may not be badly, totally hurt economically, say, as poor African Americans were really getting hit by this, and the poor in general, But they're getting hit with disillusionment that they've worked. They thought they had money that they don't have because of the stock market, or they've lost their pensions, or they've lost their jobs. So there's a lot going on in America that is really hammering the white middle class. And I'm sure you and I would agree on that.
Right. And the thing is, again, I mean, people should not be encouraged to deal with this by numbing themselves out with drugs, any kind of drugs, opioids, psych drugs, whatever. And that seems to be the only thing that's offered. Now, I do think that, as I said before, you know, there is a movement for, you know, alternative ways of doing things. I experienced something like that when I was living briefly in Canada, in Vancouver, and there was a place. It didn't model itself after anything, but it was similar to the Soteria houses that you hear about, which are started. There's a few of them starting up now around the United States, where people, rather than being drugged and locked up, they just go to a place where they're having a crisis, and they're just given emotional support and some protection from their problems for a while. And I know it really benefited me at a terrible time in my life. Of course, I was more sensible than to sign myself into a psych ward, but I was in a really bad way, and I needed that break with people, you know, giving me a lot of emotional support. I think emotional support, and you talk about empathetic therapy, Peter, which I'd like to discuss with you, or if you've written a paper about it, I'd like to read it. But my sense is you're talking about the same thing. I mean, people are helped by other human beings giving them emotional support and treating them like valuable people. And the way the psychiatric system is set up is that people go into these places and they're treated. I mean, if you're suicidal, the last thing you need is people telling you you're mentally ill and you're going to have to take drugs for the rest of your life and you better give up on your dreams because you're hopeless and helpless. That's not helpful, to say the least. And you're getting people at a time where they're the most vulnerable and they most need emotional support. And it's a pretty simple thing, except there's not big money to be made out of it, you know, like on psych drugs, you know. So, again, we're getting into a political area that we might not agree on, but...
That's all right with me. It's okay. I have a lot of respect for you.
Well, I think, you know, you have these drug companies, and they're making tons of money off drugs.
Oh, I'm in agreement about the drug companies.
Yeah.
And the flaws of capitalism and not... holding these companies to a higher legal and ethical standard.
Well, I don't know if that's really going to be possible. But anyway, if you follow the money, that's what happens. And I don't think it works. This kind of problem is not going to work when the whole motivation for doing anything about it is to make money. I don't think... I mentioned to you privately about how when I was still practicing law, I didn't like to take my clients' money. I'm not a very typical lawyer, am I? But I think that, you know, what you need is there's plenty of people in the world that really want to help, you know. I know a lot of people who went into social work and psychology and even psychiatry, and then they say, we didn't know it was going to be like this. You get people with really good motivation, you know, and they're not... Nothing's being set up to take advantage of that. I mean, there's a lot of people working in the system now, I think, that would love to work in places like a Soteria house or the place that I was in Vancouver, the Emotional Emergency Center. I mean, there's a lot of people who want to help, and I think we should find a way of connecting them up with places where they can offer help. And not just, you know, and people should make a good living out of it. There's no reason they should be well paid. But really, you know, making gazillions of dollars out of making people suffering worse with these drugs, this is not the way our society should be organized.
Yeah, let me respond to your question about, you know, what have I written about it. Just, you know, it's really important because I do care so much about these same issues that you do. I do have a book out that's called The Heart of Being Helpful. It's from a medical publisher, but Springer, but it's written for everybody, The Heart of Being Helpful. It can be a little expensive because it's from a medical publisher, and people can get it for their library to order it because it's a very good publisher, or you can probably get it pretty cheap online, or you can order it from us at pretty much cost. We're selling our books pretty much at cost to us at Bregan.com. So that's one thing. You can go for free to empathictherapy.org. We have a resource center there. People do sign up and present themselves to the public on empathictherapy.org as therapists who are in general agreement with the principles of empathic therapy. Institutions are there listed, and so are individuals. We can't vet them, so we make no pretense that we know they're what they say they are. But there's where you can find a list of people you then check out, or institutions who say they're in agreement. And I've written a two-page summary of what I mean by empathic therapy. And then, I don't know, 15 or 20 of my colleagues helped touch it up and edit it and put their name on it to show that this is something there's general agreement about. Some of our advisory council members who do therapy. So there's another place. And then my new book, my latest book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Your Overcoming Negative Emotions, is all about the attitudes and approaches we need to understand guilt, shame, and anxiety, and to get over it, to get over the numbing that goes with it, to get over the anger that goes with it, and to learn to live by reason, principles, and love. That's my general idea. We want to live by reasons, sound ethics, and a lot of love. The book's all about that. I do devote a lot of my time to these issues, Ted, that you wouldn't know about probably.
Yeah, I'm more on the pick up a picket sign and march around sort of.
Pick up picket signs anymore, but I'm very much still involved in both the critiques of psychiatry and trying to provide positive alternatives.
Heart as being helpful. I'll look for that. And what's the other? Empathictherapy.org?
.org. That's our organization.
Empathic therapy, one word.
Yeah.
Yes? Got it.
Empathictherapy.org.
I'll look for that when we get off.
I'd be interested in talking with you about that. Empathic therapy is not, quote, Peter Bregan's therapy. It's an attempt to show what are the common elements of what helps. And when we hold conferences, by the way, folks, I can tell you now because they finally got their internet stuff up. I'm going to be talking. That's my first announcement about it. March 3rd, 4th, and 5th, there's a conference in Tampa, Florida, just outside of Tampa, right on the bay. And on Friday the 4th, I'm co-sponsoring it with the Adlerian Society of Florida, Florida Adlerian Society. And on Friday the 4th, I'm going to be doing a whole day with just me, Bob Whitaker, and Peter Gercha. Peter Gercha is now one of the top researchers as a physician in the world on what's the matter with psychiatric drugs. Bob Whitaker, of course, has just done an incredible amount. So for a full day, you're just going to hear me and Bob Whitaker talking and Peter Gercha, and we're going to have tons of interaction where you can just talk with us. And then on Saturday, Peter's going to do Gercha's going to do us a presentation in the morning. And then later at 2:00, I'm going to give 75 minutes workshop where you can just come talk to me about everything. So there's going to be a lot of contact with us at this combined conference with the Florida Adlerian Society. If you Google Florida Adlerian Society Conference 2016, you'll get there. And also, there is a connection on my website that will give you a brochure, and by tomorrow you'll also have a link there to the sign up, the automatic sign up online.
It sounds,
I, It's going to be an exciting conference, actually. Yeah, it's going to be amazing.
I think the three of you are among the most, you know, really respected people in this area. I mean, Bob, I can't pronounce his name.
Gurcha.
Yeah, I've read a lot of his. Boy, he's pretty outspoken. I mean, he's got this book, what's it called? He compares the drug companies to the mafia, and I don't think that he's far off either. I mean, hey, they're killing people for money.
I don't think they're far off at all. I mean, I've looked inside these drug companies, and they clearly, many of them, GlaxoSmithKline I've looked inside of, Upjohn I've looked inside of, Eli Lilly I've looked inside of. And I mean, these drug companies, they're selling trash. And then when they get criticized, they don't look and see if they're causing adverse effects. Like folks are saying, they set up committees to fight. And they, GlaxoSmithKline and Eli Lilly have purposely set up systems to avoid recording things like suicides in their clinical trials. And they've purposely withheld data from the FDA. And some of those companies have been paying billions of dollars to the federal government, who's finally caught on that what I'm saying is true. But those billions don't dent enough what these companies are making. One of the interesting things for you and I to talk about sometime on the air, which I haven't ever really done, is to talk at length about, from our two different perspectives, your progressive perspective, my more libertarian, small government perspective, is what do in the world do we do about these big corporations, because they're not part of what our founding fathers want. They're not consistent with our Constitution. These huge corporations that just run roughshod over people because they've got all the money. There's no question about that. And with that, I have complete agreement with progressive people because I've seen it. I didn't want to see it, but I've seen it.
Well, the problem is, and I don't know if we should get into this, but
Why don't you speak to it for a moment from your viewpoint?
Well, I mean, the thing is, you have, you know what? I'm not actually that ideological, so maybe I'm not the person to even try to give an intellectual analysis. All I see is you have these. I mean, I think capitalism traces back. I think actually it was the Dutch that created the modern corporation. And it was designed to, you know, free up, allow people to take financial risks without getting swamped. And probably in the beginning it was a good thing. But what you've created is such a powerful institutions now that just run wild over the society. And that's, you know, you've got to take away the power of these corporations. And you know who I'd be talking about if this was just a political. I think this kind of discussion, Peter, you and I should have privately, because I know you're a pretty conservative guy in some ways.
Yeah, but I don't mind this at all, because this is the real problem. I mean, when I hear Bernie Sanders talk about the effects of big corporations on America and the world, I know it firsthand as a product liability medical expert. I know it firsthand.
Yep. We got to stop worshiping money, too. I mean, I could have been a lot richer than I am. I'm pretty poor. But the thing is, why is it – we're getting far away from shock treatment, though, here. But maybe we
don't. I don't mind. I think folks are probably only able to bear a little bit of discussion of shock treatment, and you're a valuable resource in other areas.
Well, I think, you know, this worship of money, this idea that money is somehow you're successful the more money you make. Now, sometimes I imagine myself with a lot of money, but a lot of money to me is enough to buy a nice house and maybe get a new car and things like that. But I don't need $17 billion to do that. And if I found myself with $17 billion, I'd find socially valuable things to do with it. I don't understand. I know, for instance, one of the things that's supposed to make you really successful is if you have a yacht, and I know that some places, like I have this friend that they had not a yacht, just a little boat. They like, and they said there were just tons of yachts docked where they were that the people who owned them never used. Why would you buy a yacht if you never use it? What is the point? Just to say that you have a yacht? And it's like this, Margaret Mead wrote about this Northwest tribe, I think they were called the Kwakutl, and they, one of the things they did is they, the rich ones would pile everything they could possibly find. They'd have marvelous artwork made and things like that, every possession that that society considered to be valuable and good, and they'd put them in the center of the village and they'd set fire to them. Well, that sort of sounds like what we do now. I mean, what's the point of having money if all you do is show off? Do you really need a $20,000 bottle of wine? I mean, I read that about this hedge fund guy, the one who raised the price of some, you know, some really important drug from what, $750 a pill to $2,000 a pill or something like that, and he's drinking 20,000 bottles of wine. What do you want with a $20,000 bottle of wine? What is the point of that? To show everybody you have $20,000 to throw away? And that kind of attitude, I mean, you're not, it's like you don't even care about your fellow human beings, but you care more about things. And I think if you take this idea and trace it to what's going on, it's the same thing. Why are these people in this drug companies? What is the point of making a gazillion dollars? You can have a very comfortable life with a whole lot less money. I mean, prosperity, you know, upper middle class, that's okay. But you want to kill people in order to become a billionaire and people respect that? We have to stop saying that this is something valuable. We have to say, enough of this nonsense. There's something better than money in this society. To me, what makes me happy is to be with friends, to help them, to get help from them, to see them become happy. That's the way I want to live my life. Now, like I say, I could do with a little bit more money, but I'm fine. I have what I need. I have a car that runs and a stereo and all that, and I don't make much money, and I'm just fine. And if I had more, what do I need? I don't need that stuff, and neither does anybody else. You know, you just don't need a gazillion dollars to be happy. Money, you know, it's like a cliche that money can't buy happiness, but in fact, it's true. Money can buy things if you need certain, you really do need certain things. Well, okay, but happiness doesn't come from a pile of money. Happiness doesn't come from things, to me. It's just not, and that's why you wind up with people allowing themselves to be conned by the drug companies and thinking, if you're unhappy, here's some things for you, drugs. They'll knock out your humanity and just turn you into a sort of a zombie, but you won't feel any pain. What's that supposed to be about? It just doesn't make any sense to me. And if you didn't have this worship of money, we'd have a whole lot better society. And we wouldn't have shock treatment. I mean, people wouldn't put up with such a thing. If our vision of society was to make for as many people as possible to have decent, happy lives, shock treatment would be just totally out of the question, you know, and these mind-numbing, dangerous, destructive drugs would be totally out of the question, you know. It just wouldn't happen because at bottom, of course, you have all this, because the people who control these things are making a lot of money out of it. And that's why, like, I'm repeating myself, but I just can't really understand. I can't understand why our society thinks these material things are so, it just doesn't make any sense to me.
I'm really, really glad to have you talk about, in a sense, what is the wisdom that you've learned, as I have, from a long life. We're both getting older, and
I think we're the same age.
What?
I think you and I are the exact same age, aren't we?
I'm not going to announce my age.
Well, I'm pretty sure.
It's too obvious.
We're very close in age.
Ginger, Ginger Warren. She said, "You're operating like a man 20 or 30 years younger. Forget your age." What you're saying on a living life level is something I deeply believe, that we need a certain amount of money for security.
Right.
And beyond that, the greatest use of money is what you can use it for to help other human beings, which Ginger and I both believe in very much, including family and including the money that takes us to, you know, do a lot of reform work. And to me, what's clear as day as I get older is that happiness as an experience and joy in life has a huge amount to do with who you're closest to in life. What is your relationship like with your wife, your husband, your children, your best friend, the people you work for or who work for you? Those close relationships we see as increasingly important as we look at life and where we've gone. The issues you raise are cultural and educational and spiritual and religious. I think they're a little separate from what in the world do we use as an organizing principle for society. And clearly, if we're going to use capitalism or free enterprise, we don't have it. We have now is government collusion with large industry or anybody else who has a lot of money. I mean, that's what we have. It's a kind of fascism, really. It's the government gives money to corporations, and corporations help elect and give money back. And
yes, it's very corrupt.
And it's not just corporations, Stu. It's also things that are – and often the corporations are funding Obama because that's what they're going to get something from.
The whole problem. I mean, not the whole problem, but the – have a political system now where you run out and you get money from these people so you can run your campaign, and then of course you're not going to take away their power when they're financing your campaign. It just doesn't
exactly
work. Peter, I'm going to convince you yet to vote for Bernie Sanders. I can't resist teasing you, man.
No, I don't mind having these discussions at all, because I think that, in fact, Bernie's right about that. I think he's very, very wrong about we'll have free this, have free that, and have free everything, because, in fact, the system's already collapsing under giving away free things. So that's sort of like one of the major ways we would differ in view.
Well, we could have a good discussion, but maybe we should.
Well,
go
we
back
could,
because
we're decent folks. We know that each other are trying our best.
I know. I think you and I, what we have in common and what I've learned, I mean, I have a close friend now who's extremely conservative. And she's, you know, but she's also, she plays the organ in church, which is pretty conservative. But I'm not a religious person at all. But you know what? She's motivated to really help people. I mean, she really has a vision of the world where everybody should be able to be happy and get what they need in life. And she's an extremely conservative person, but she's a good, decent person. And she and I both, at bottom, have the same goals. We both like to see the same result, you know. So I've learned recently that I can talk to conservative people, unless they're like fascists, and I won't name any names, but there's a lot of conservative people who really want the same things I'd want to see. And, you know, and that you want to see. And I think there's got to be a way, you know, for instance, when we talk about psychiatric stuff here, I think there's a lot of conservatives who really have a better position on the issues I'm concerned about than liberals do, which kind of saddens me, you know.
Well, there's no doubt about it, Ted. I'm much more frequently on conservative networks, both the Fox Business and the Fox News Network. I've been on several times about drugs issues and the veterans being drugged and so on. And the only other place that, other than that lately that has had me on has been Tom Hartman. just grits his teeth when I come up and he has me on.
Well, what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, what I think it is, it's the libertarian tendency in conservatism. They feel the government should be meddling in people's private lives.
Exactly.
That's exactly
that's
what psychiatry does. You know, and I think you have, which I think is, I consider my, we're getting pretty far off the shot.
No,
I'm very
happy to get some of your wisdom on mine on the radio.
I consider myself a libertarian socialist. That's my latest formulation of my politics, because I don't think the government should be meddling in people's lives, but it should be offering people things that help them get their lives together, not, you know, and then you go back to the whole idea of forced psychiatry. I mean, you should, if psychiatry has something to offer, it should just offer it. It shouldn't force itself on people, you know, because anything that's forced on people is generally not good for them, you know.
Almost always.
Yeah. So
especially if it has anything to do with their psychosocial lives. I mean, about the only time that forcing anything on anybody is worthwhile is if they're absolutely delirious and brain damaged and you're in an ER and you got to hold them down and treat them for the acute pneumonia that has made them toxic or whatever else. But these are such limited circumstances. Almost any other time, you're going to harm people because people have to do just what you said. They have to face their life. And that's, by the way, I think is a heart of a conservative position and a libertarian position, is that we have to take charge of our lives, for God's sakes. That's where progressivism, I think, does a huge disservice to America's, because it just increases the dole and increases the idea of be a victim and blame.
Well,
and it's one thing to know how evil the world is. It's another thing to then give in to it. You got to take charge of your life.
But sometimes you need – I mean, I've been a beneficiary of certain government programs that were really helpful. I mean, I say that I worked my way through college, and I was working when I was in college. But I had two very good contacts with the vocational rehabilitation, one in New York, and they got me into college, and one out here in California, and they got me into law school. And these are government programs, and if they hadn't been there – I wouldn't have been able to go to college, and I wouldn't have been able to go to law school, and my life would have been very different. But I think, you know, it's very limited, and it's for certain people, but it's a government program that I would hope somebody like you, who's conservative and has a heart, would support. I mean, I think you would.
Well, you know, there's hardly a conservative in the U.S. who doesn't think we need some sort of safety net to help people. Really, that's really true. I hear the music play. Ted Chapasinski. Ted, spell your name and as the music sounds, and we're saying goodbye, folks.
C-H-A-B-A-S, as in summertime, I, N as in Nancy, S-K-I. And with that last name, you can Google me. Find my email address, anybody who wants to contact me. And thank you very much for having me on your show today, Peter.
I've really enjoyed a bit of a political conversation. Bye-bye now, folks.